India is a disaster for the working class and the poor today. Unless the ruling class has stopped, it's going to get far worse. Why? Because leading elements of the class see that the current period is an opportunity for them to step up on the world stage. And this is a many years long project. And to do it, they know they're determined to exploit the working class more intensely, to liquidate parts of the middle class, to repress Muslims and dissidents. And ruling on behalf of the class is the far-right Hindu nationalist party, the BJP. The government, the ruling class, does face some resistance from below. The biggest and most organized one today is the farmers' movement against the BJP's agriculture policy, which strengthens agribusiness corporations against farmers. In the past couple of years, there have also been widespread social movements, protests against the introduction of anti-Muslim laws. And there's also a sizable trade union movement, which is largely under the sway of a bureaucratic leadership that's passive and conciliatory to the bosses. It's not combative. Okay, so that's the gist of the picture of India today. Now, the first half of the talk, I'll go through some of the main political events of the last 2 years. And the second half, I'll talk about the forces of the right and the forces of the left. Okay? Let me just share my screen. So let's start with how the ruling class has managed the pandemic, because it really shows how little they care about the lives of poor people. First, some stats and observations. Officially, India has had about 440,000 deaths from COVID, but this is an underestimate. Experts say it's at least 10 times that. So 4.4 million deaths from COVID, and it could be much worse. We just don't know. And then apart from deaths and illness, there's also the livelihood effects of the pandemic on the poor. Since the pandemic, an additional 230 million people fell below the state-defined poverty line. Since the pandemic, an additional 97 million fell into the category of people facing severe or moderate food insecurity. So why such severe effects? Like, why hundreds of millions falling into poverty because of the pandemic? Well, lots of reasons. First, India's welfare system is pretty minimal. A lot of households are just left to fend for themselves. A large majority of Indian workers don't have formal contracts. So even if they returned to employment after the lockdown-related economic disruptions, they often returned to lower wages, worse conditions, more casualized, because bosses are exploiting the sudden desperation of workers. Then there are also factors to do with farming households and migrant labor, because it's long been a social problem in India that a sizable chunk of poor farmer households are in chronic and severe debt. So these are small farming households. They own a small bit of land, but it's not enough to sustain them. So the majority of their annual income is from waged work, often by family members who work in the city in jobs like construction. And these sorts of jobs are often daily wage jobs. You either get some work that day or you don't. And they have no formal contracts. They're often sleeping at the work site. So for a lot of these kinds of farming households, they were really counting on that wage packet from the city. And when that vanished overnight because of a badly implemented lockdown, these households only survived the pandemic period by taking on more debt. And that's debt not just to banks, it's debt to rich farmers and shopkeepers at racketeering interest rates with harsh conditions for not making your repayments, like you forfeit your cattle, you forfeit your farm, you become bonded labor for the moneylender. So that's why the effects of the pandemic are so severe economically. So why are the ruling class doing all this? Because the ruling class has decided to use the pandemic to its advantage. They will barely be touched by it, right? They're protected by a wall of money. They will hunker down. They will have the best healthcare if they get sick. they will keep getting richer in the meantime. The burden will fall mostly on the workers and the poor, who will become more desperate, and the balance of social forces will shift further in favor of the bosses. So as far as the ruling class is concerned, their mouths are watering at the thought of lower wages from desperate workers, at the thought of cheap land to buy up from failing small farmers. That's why the ruling class has been so callous about the spread of infection. The big national lockdown in March 2020, at the start of the first wave in India, was done with no adequate provisions for the mass of the urban poor. No food kitchens, no shelters were provided to them, right? So remember that the construction workers on the previous slide sleeping on the work site. Well, if your work site is closed, where are you going to sleep? So really a big portion of the poor migrant labor who live on a daily wage and sleep at their work site, they had to leave the cities and go back home to their small farming households. It's estimated that about 10 million people left the cities and went back to the villages, spreading the virus, right? This is the original super spreader event in India. And then this year in April, India's second wave was sparked by more super spreader events. One of them was the BJP, the ruling party, promoting huge Hindu pilgrimages. This was playing up to a section of its base of religious organizations who make money from organizing these events. Another set of super spreader events was a series of huge campaign rallies for state elections in states where the BJP is not in power and it wants to displace the incumbents. All right, so you might wonder, could the government have done more to help the poor? I mean, India is a poor country, right? Maybe they just couldn't have done any more. The answer is absolutely they could have done more. It's not, you know, ordinary people are poor. The ruling class is not poor. They're rich in India. India has enormous public granaries. The stockpile of grain in these granaries is actually way above the usual norm that they have. Economists calculated that the government could have given 80% of the population of the whole country enough grain to last them for 6 months and still be above the normal level of the stockpile, right? So they're just huge amounts of grain sitting idle in warehouses, some of it rotting. But to give it to the poor, to give it to the needy, would have meant that grain prices plummet and agribusiness is hurt. So they didn't do that. Another overlooked relief measure was the government has long had a public works program in the countryside to counter the chronic unemployment and underemployment in the villages. The government could have easily expanded that public works program and extended it to the cities as well. Again, it didn't do it. Like, it was easy for it to do it. It knew how to do it. It chose not to. Why didn't they do these things? Because you don't get to be a big deal on the world stage by frittering away your money on the poor. You do it by exploiting them more intensely. Okay, so the next part of what's been happening over the last couple of years in India is a Hindu nationalist and corporate assault. So in mid-2019, before the pandemic, the government escalated repression in Muslim-majority Kashmir. Then in late 2019, before the pandemic began, the federal government introduced anti-Muslim laws throughout the country. In mid-2020, anti-worker changes to labor laws were introduced in several economically important states in the country. Laws like increasing the workday from 9 hours to 12 hours, or reducing the coverage of accident compensation at the workplace, things like that. And then in late 2020, the government pushed through farm laws that, as I said, strengthen agribusiness against big farmers and against local grain merchants. Okay, so that's the corporate assault and the Hindu fundamentalist assault. But there's also been resistance to the ruling class agenda. First, there was resistance against the BJP's anti-Muslim laws. These were the biggest protests in decades in India. They lasted for several months, and for a while it seemed like the state couldn't stop them. The police force beat protesters. They vandalized and intimidated Muslim neighborhoods. Far-right Hindutva mobs caused riots in Delhi, killing dozens of Muslims. The police and the courts didn't pursue them, like they're scot-free walking around. Police and far-right mobs attacked university campuses that are left strongholds. They just went into libraries and beat people up. Nonetheless, the protests persisted. But finally, the protests wound down with the first national lockdown in March 2020. And soon after that, under the cover of lockdown, the BJP arrested many of the prominent student leaders. The movement hasn't really recovered since then. The same kinds of crowds haven't been mobilized since then on this topic. But then there were also the farmer movements. In the late months of 2020, this was an even larger and more organized movement. And it was against the farm laws. At their peak, the farmers movement had hundreds of thousands of people encamped around New Delhi, the capital, blockading all the major highways into it. The movement is still going now with long drawn out negotiations, which are apparently going nowhere, between some of the farmer unions and the state. Okay, so that's a bit of a picture of the ruling class assault and some resistance. Now, on to the right and the left in society. So first, what is the political right in society? Now, as I said, the BJP are the party in power. But to understand their strength in society, you have to understand the whole broader nexus of right-wing forces with which they interact. And that's forces anywhere from standard, run-of-the-mill, conservative cultural organizations through to fascist militia. So the BJP, the parliamentary party, is a cog in the right-wing machine, and it moves bigger forces, right? A central organization of the right is the RSS in the top left corner here. The RSS began in the 1920s, inspired by Mussolini. They're fascists, they're anti-communists, they're anti-Muslim. Their leadership and cadre has always been largely from the urban petty bourgeoisie, the urban middle class. The RSS set up the BJP as their parliamentary wing, and most of the upper leadership of the BJP are RSS cadre. But they're still different organizations, RSS and BJP. They mobilize different groups of people for different kinds of actions. The RSS needs the BJP. Indian society would look very different if the RSS could bypass the BJP and win elections directly, right? If the big capitalists could directly and openly support the RSS rather than supporting the BJP, that would be a different balance of social forces. Okay, after that, there's a range of militia, the bottom right picture. Some of these militia are formally affiliated to the RSS, and they've played a role in organizing and carrying out anti-Muslim pogroms in recent decades, in past decades. So killing hundreds, sometimes thousands of Muslims. Other militia are organizationally independent, but they still have some kind of Hindu nationalist ideology. Yet others might not have begun with any ideology at all, like local mafia or strike breakers for hire or landlords' militia to intimidate agricultural laborers. Their existence is part of how bosses control workers in the normal workings of capitalism in India. So their existence isn't necessarily due to some sudden fascist radicalization of previously unorganized individuals. It's not due entirely to the ideological success of the RSS activists. It's a kind of separate dynamic. Okay, and then there's a range of Hindu cultural organizations and religious organizations with which the BJP has cemented relationships over the decades, the top right corner. So these kinds of cultural organizations, they have their own independent bases of followers, mostly run-of-the-mill conservatives. Being able to mobilize these broader layers has been very important for the BJP. It still remains important for them electorally. But in the 1980s, the BJP's ability to mobilize these social layers of run-of-the-mill conservatives in political campaigns that were dressed up as religious pilgrimages were pivotal to the BJP becoming a serious player on the national political landscape. Now that the more that the BJP has risen in power since the 80s, the more these other more independent right-wing forces have tailed the BJP, right? Because they see opportunities for personal advancement. So understanding how the BJP fits in this broader network is important to see why the BJP is so entrenched. It's because it taps into this broader nexus of right-wing organizations, right? It's not just they have an ideology which people believe. It's not as simple as that. And finally, there's the ruling class in the bottom left corner. As the BJP gained prominence in electoral politics from the 80s onwards, it could draw behind it more and more capitalists. And of course, the more it could do that, the better it could do in elections because it had more money. And especially over the 2000s and 2010s, when the BJP held the chief ministerships, which is like the premiers in Australia, when they held the chief ministerships in economically important states in the west and north of India, they really pushed the boss's agenda against workers. They gave out huge state subsidies to factories and things, and they drew behind them a layer of ruling class figures like Gautam Adani from the Adani Corporation, which is building the coal mine in Queensland. His family is worth $78 billion. Or Mukesh Ambani, who owns the most expensive house in the world, costing between $1 billion and $2 billion US dollars. That's 27 stories, just one house, with five helipads and five gardens. And Ratan Tata from the Tata Group, which owns Jaguar and Land Rover and lots of other crap. So while Modi, the current prime minister, was the chief minister in Gujarat, the state of Gujarat, he helped Tata with heavy state subsidies to set up a big auto manufacturing site. Now, this is also representative of how the ruling class has shifted from other parties to the BJP, because the Tatas as a family are an old capitalist dynasty. They trace back to Jamsetji Tata, who was one of the leading Indian industrialists in the 1870s and 1880s. Okay, so those are some of the forces of the right and the ruling class. What about the unions? Well, India has a bunch of separate trade union federations, right? So each of these is a kind of peak union body, but they're all separate. Each of them affiliated to a different parliamentary party. Some of those parties have a working class base, like the ALP does. Others have a middle class base. Last year, these federations banded together for a one-day general strike against right-wing industrial relations agenda. They claim they got out 200 million workers. Though I've heard other people on the Indian revolutionary left say it's more like 50 million. Well, whatever, it's still a big number. So what do we make of this? Is this kind of a strike a sign of a combative working class? Unfortunately, not really, as far as I can tell. The strike is part of a tradition of annual set piece, one-day demonstration strikes that go back for a decade. They're called from above by the union bureaucracy. They have nothing to do with the rank and file pushing the bureaucrats to call a strike. But over the past decade in India, there have been rank and file struggles. So, for instance, in the economically important auto manufacturing sector, there were efforts to create industry-wide unions for the first time in that industry. And that was by rank and file activism, right? It wasn't by the big union federations. And those efforts were repressed first by company thugs, then by the police and courts. And the courts sentenced some of those unionists to life imprisonment for murder for defending themselves against violent company thugs. So you would expect the union federations, if they're combative bodies, to try and relate to these layers, right? How did they try to relate? Well, while the rank and file drive was happening, the federations did little to amplify or spread these. What they did instead was just try to sign up the new unions to their federations. That's about the limit of their involvement. When the prison sentences were given, which are obviously going to have a chilling effect on workers throughout the country unless you stand up against it, what did the union federations do? They did not take any solidarity action to denounce these, right? That's a, like, these were very important struggles for the labor movement in the past decade. And the big union federations more or less just stood by and did nothing to relate to it. So the union bureaucracy are cowards. You can't rely on them to resist the corporate assault, let alone to stand up to fascist tactics. Okay, so that's the parlous state of the unions. What about the farmers' movement? How should the working class movement relate to the farmers' movement? Well, the answer to that is a bit different in our tradition, in socialist alternative, than it is for the Stalinist and Maoist currents, which predominate on the left in India. Before we get to the current movement, who are farmers as a class in India? First, they're a class of small business, right? So they're a middle class, but they're also, as a class, they're internally very differentiated. The majority of farmers in India have small plots and little capital. And they're very uncompetitive in the market. And they're often very indebted. And they rely significantly on additional income from wages. About a third of farming households in India get 80% of their income, of their annual income, from wages, right? So it gives some sense of how they're kind of in between being farming households and working class households. A very small proportion of the Indian farmers are more competitive, big farmers, and they have a secure future as small businesses, whereas these smaller farmers don't have a secure future as small businesses because they're kind of being liquidated. Okay, so on to the current farmers' movement. Well, what is the movement? Actually, there's a lot of elements behind it. It's not a spontaneous movement. There's lots of organizations which have made it happen. And these are organizations of different types. So there's a bunch of farmer unions, and then there's civil society organizations. And a bunch of them can have progressive, pro-worker attitudes. But I think the way to judge the movement as a whole is not to look at the smaller forces, but to look at the leading forces within the movement, right? You can't judge it just by the smaller organizations that are tailing along. And the leading forces are really the farmer unions in the top left corner here, not the left farmer unions, which I'll discuss briefly later, and not the civil society groups and urban groups. Okay, so the leading forces within the movement seem to be acting for the interest of the upper part of the farmer class, because those people, the upper part of the farming class, they're the ones for whom being a farmer is most secure as an income, and where having an income from farming as opposed to from wage labor on somebody else's farm is the main part of their income, right? So for instance, the BJP's three farm laws that it passed and that the farmers' movement opposes, those laws affect different people differently. And which demands the movement takes up and fights for the most strongly is some indication of which group of farmers has the most influence within the movement, right? So it's a way of gauging who are the leading elements and who are the tailing elements. Well, the main demands of the leaders of the farmers' movement have been about the farm law that signals an end to the government guaranteed minimum support price for specific crops. That minimum support price is supposed to keep crop prices higher in the market than they would be otherwise. Now, A minimum support price is of great interest to big farmers because they rely for income, they rely solely on selling their farm produce. So the higher the prices, the better off they are. But it's not so clear for the small farmers because for the small farming households, their income is mostly from wages, not from selling their produce. They're net buyers of basic foodstuffs. They're not net sellers of basic foodstuffs. So for them, if rice and lentil prices are higher, that means their wages don't stretch as far, right? So the elimination of the minimum support price would actually be a net benefit to the smaller farmers. So the fact that the farmers' movement is fighting so strongly for the guarantee of the maintenance of the minimum support price is some indication that it's being led by the bigger farmers, and the smaller farmers' movements, like the left farmer unions, are just tailing along. They have little influence in the movement. Oh, hold on. I need to share my screen again. Just a sec. Technical difficulties. My goodness. All right. Oh, that's the end of the thing. Okay, great. All right. That's not the end of the talk. It's just the end of the slides. Hold on. There's more. Okay, so a few points about how the big communist parties have oriented to the farmers' movement. Now, coming from the Stalinist tradition, they tend to fudge issues about class independence for the workers' movement. And I think they've ended up as left cover for the interests of the big farmers at a time when you could campaign for agricultural laborers to get higher wages or to have public works programs, right? If you want to relate to this layer of semi-proletarianized small farmers, in my opinion, you should do it as a workers' organization, not by becoming a farmers' union. Because the point is to win this layer away from a farming class standpoint and win them to a working class standpoint. And you can't do that by becoming a farmers' union, even with the best of intentions, because inevitably by being a farmers' union, you have to think and fight from the class standpoint of farmers. Okay, another kind of debate on the Indian left is there's clearly a growing fascist danger on the right, right? So there's a far right party in power and things can easily get much more fascistic because they have the cadre ready to do it. So a debate on the left is whether people should go for a people's front of workers and farmers or a united front of workers alone. Now, it's one thing to form kind of temporary tactical alliances while it suits you for a specific time. But it's another thing to talk about a reliable class ally. And the middle classes are not reliable against fascism. So your orientation should be to build the independent forces of the working class, not its dependent relations with another class. So some concrete examples of what I mean by this. Concrete examples of how some of the non-communist party farmer unions have acted towards workers and the oppressed. So last year, during the pandemic, when there was a temporary farm labor shortage in parts of the country, some of these same farmer unions that are protesting today banded together to agree not to raise wages, right? So the class antagonism between being a farmer and being a farm worker clearly cut against whatever Stalinist slogan you want about farmer-peasant alliance here. Next, there's anti-Dalit politics has been prominent in some of these non-CP farmer unions in past years. Dalits are a marginalized group in India who are excluded from being farmers and they're mostly agricultural labor. Next, in some regions, Hindu-dominated non-CP farmer unions have been involved in pogroms against Muslims as recently as 8 years ago. So today, some of those same farmer unions claim, we've seen the error of our ways, and actually we need communal harmony if we're going to defeat the BJP's corporate agenda. Well, that's hopeful, that's a good thing, but it's hard not to suspect a degree of political opportunism here. Who knows how they'll react next time that there's a political opportunity pushing in the opposite direction from maybe from the BJP itself. Like if you get more money and connections from the BJP, who's to guarantee they won't turn against Muslims again? Really underlying all of this is that there's a common middle class base, both for the farmers' movement and for fascist movements, which means that in times of great social turmoil, when the middle classes are squeezed, portions of it can move quite easily from being populist to being fascist because their class interests align without any need for great soul searching and ideological conversion or anything, right? It doesn't mean they will all do it, obviously, but it just makes the class less reliable for the left. Okay, so just to finish up, I'm just going to summarize what I've said already. So the ruling class and the BJP-led state executive in particular are determined to face the coming period of intense inter-imperial rivalry with a class assault against workers and parts of the middle class. The impact of the pandemic and the economic crisis more generally is severe and a lasting one for these sections as well. And the crackdown on dissent continues. Far-right organizations are confident at the moment, including ones which are independent of the RSS and BJP, which see opportunities for their own advancement by jumping on the bandwagon, one-upping each other, and using the Hindutva ideology to cloak their own power plays. It's likely that things will get worse for workers and the poor over the next few years, unless there's a pushback from below. So what are the chances of that? Not high, I think. In my opinion, while the farmers' movement has been a welcome, positive development to stand up to the right-wing assault, it's not a reliable ally, as I said, in the medium term. Meanwhile, the trade union bureaucracies are not combative. The last rank-and-file upsurge of union activism around the auto belt was beaten back about 4 or 5 years ago. And the largest left electoral parties, the CPM and CPI, are quite moribund, except for their student groups. The student left remains active despite police repression, but it doesn't have the wider social forces to connect to as it did during the protests against the anti-Muslim laws a year ago. Okay, that's it. Thank you.